This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Well, there is legislation in Congress that at first blush would seem to be something that would make anti-smoking activists very happy. It's H.R. 1108. That's the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act from Henry Waxman down here in L.A. And in essence, what it would do would be to give the Food and Drug Administration for the first time the ability to regulate tobacco products. And that would include banning the use of all artificial or natural flavors in cigarettes, which is a big deal because many people, many critics think that this is a way that the tobacco industry tries to lure younger smokers and hook teens with these sweet flavored cigarettes and get them as lifetime customers. But there is a very big loophole here. The ban on artificial or natural flavors would accept menthol. And menthol cigarettes account for almost a third of the $70 billion U.S. cigarette market. But no less importantly, they're the cigarette of choice in the black community. Nearly 75% of African-American smokers use menthol cigarettes. In fact, an American Legacy Foundation survey found that among teen smokers, 81% of African-Americans smoke menthol cigarettes, compared with only 32% of whites and 45% of Hispanics. So does this legislation unfairly discriminate against black smokers? Your calls on this are going to be very welcome in a moment. But first, to get the lay of the land, we're joined by Stephanie Saul. She's a staff writer at the New York Times. Ms. Saul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
So on the one hand, this looks like a Christmas gift to anti-smoking types because it brings the FDA in to regulate tobacco products. But then there's this menthol exception. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, this bill has been debated for a number of years. And around 2003, there was concern raised by Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire, about flavored cigarettes. And at that time, one company had started marketing chocolate cigarettes and strawberry cigarettes and a variety of other fruit and candy flavors. And Senator Gregg asked that a provision be placed in the bill banning those. So this provision was put in that bans flavorings, but it specifically exempts menthol from that ban. And, you know, I spoke to Senator Gregg about this, and he said he would have been in favor of banning menthol at the time he put that provision in, but he was told that it wasn't doable, and it was pretty much a deal breaker for the tobacco industry.
Well, I've read that, in fact, the big boy in the tobacco camp, Philip Morris, is the one big tobacco company that does support this legislation, but some say that what got Philip Morris to the table was the menthol exception. Do you think that's a fair read?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that was, I think, maybe one of the things that might have brought them to the table. But I think there were a lot of different compromises that were made on the bill. I'm not sure that was the primary reason.
Well, considering the preponderance of menthol cigarettes in the black community, it certainly had to occur to somebody that this would be a segment of the population that would be impacted to a much greater extent than others if menthol cigarettes got a pass for the FDA.
I think, you know, menthol is controversial for a number of reasons, and that's one of them, that menthol cigarettes have been heavily marketed to African Americans, and that group seems to have a higher proportion of smoking-related cancers than other people. It also masks the taste of tobacco. So, you know, remember your first cigarette and how you started coughing immediately? Menthol can make it easier to start smoking by, you know, masking that harsh flavor. And that's one reason it's been put in cigarettes and one reason it's controversial.
All right, Stephanie Saul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Your thoughts on this topic are very welcome, where you stand on this particular legislation. And what about the menthol exception? Do you think this unfairly targets the black community? 866-893-5722 is our number, or 866-893-KPCC. Very interested in getting your thoughts on this. We're also joined by Brad Sherman. He's Democratic Congressman from the San Fernando Valley's 27th Congressional District. Mr. Sherman, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, and glad you're talking about a bill that Henry Waxman has been pushing for a long time that I've been proud to co-sponsor.
So what's good about this bill?
Well, it is not perfect, and if we failed to pass good bills that weren't perfect, we wouldn't pass any good bills at all. It gives the FDA the ability to regulate tobacco, prevents unproven claims from being made about, oh, this is light, it won't hurt you, and restricts the sales and marketing to children. And while it doesn't stop all flavoring, it stops the flavoring that would allow a new product that hasn't existed in the marketplace before to go out there and recruit new smokers.
All right, but the flavoring that we're talking about that is allowed is menthol. And as I said before, nearly a third of all cigarettes sold in the U.S. are menthol cigarettes, but nearly three-quarters of all cigarettes sold to African Americans are menthol cigarettes. So where does the menthol exemption come from?
Practicality. First of all, there are many people who smoke menthol cigarettes. I don't think that they're addicted to the menthol. They're addicted to the tobacco. And so I don't know whether we would get people to stop smoking if menthol cigarettes were not available. And in fact, there are many smokers that prefer menthol. If they can't find menthol, they buy the other. Clearly, though, if we could pass a ban on menthol along with everything else, that would make this a better bill.
Then why don't we?
Well, because I and Waxman don't have all the votes in Congress.
But again, I guess what I'm not clear on is what's stopping you? Where does the opposition for this lie?
The Republican Party, the tobacco lobby. I mean, this bill is not that new. It didn't move at all in 2007. And in fact, predecessor bills have been introduced for years. The power of the tobacco lobby in Washington is famous and the subject of many books.
All right. Your thoughts on this bill are very welcome. 866-893-5722. Also want to point out that we put in calls to the American Lung Association, the Heart Association, the American Medical Association, the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. They all said they're in favor of this bill, but they declined to come on. Joining us right now is William S. Robinson. He's executive director of the African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Mr. Robinson, welcome to the program.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
Now, your group supported this bill, and then a couple of weeks ago, it didn't support this bill. What happened?
Well, about a month ago, when I became the director of the organization that you mentioned back in the early fall of 2006, the bill was sent to me in the late fall by the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and knowing about the bill, we had been working in tobacco control to get a bill passed for probably 10 years, and it was sent out urgently back in 2006, late 2006, with, you know, it's moving now, we think it's the closest we've come to this. So we signed on to the bill. I told Campaign, let me read the bill first, and we will see what we will do with it. So I took an evening, read the bill, and immediately saw that menthol was treated differently than the other flavored additives. And I called Campaign back and said, we will sign on as a supporter, but we reserve the right to come back to this menthol issue at some time that we deem is critical. And we wanted to see how close this bill would be to getting passed and getting out of committee before we redress that. And we were in support of the bill. The boards met, and we decided we would stay on as a supporter. But as this thing moved, we would look at the bill a little bit closer and really begin to talk about and raise the issue about this disparate or different treatment of menthol as this this one additive.
Well, let's talk about that, Mr. Robinson. It seems by all studies that if about three-quarters of African-American smokers prefer menthol cigarettes, then this is the community that clearly has most at stake if menthol gets a pass from the FDA. Do you feel that black smokers are being unfairly targeted by the medical establishment?
Well, not by the medical establishment, this bill in particular. And what we do know about properties of menthol outside of anything else. We put them in cough drops, we put them in balms, we put them in salves. So we know that there's this soothing and cooling effect that's a property of menthol in its, you know, in any form. So we do know that it softens the harshness of cigarettes and tobacco products when first ingested. So your bodily reaction is less than it would be because it actually deadens your defense mechanisms when you initially uptake.
All right, but my point here is that if the AMA and the Lung Association and the Heart Association are all signing off on this bill, which clearly gives it the imprimatur of validity in the eyes of many, what does the black community make of that?
Well, it doesn't mean that they're right just because they support the bill. And I think you could tell from Representative Sherman's responses that a lot of this may have happened as a compromise between the tobacco lobby and in their influence in Congress. And one of the things that we believe is that we should never be negotiating a bill with the tobacco industry at the table if we're talking about protecting the public's health. We just think that they shouldn't be at the table. Now, if they want to speak in public forums and a public hearing about what should be in their legislation, fine. But to negotiate with them for a bill that is designed to give the federal entity that's tasked with protecting the public's health, it seems like a just overt contradiction to us.
And for that reason, you guys pulled your support.
And we pulled our support for it. And just imagine, if we could get rid of menthol, this is what we say. And we've heard some very kind of interesting and what I consider weak rationale as to why menthol was exempted. If we could make menthol disappear tomorrow, we think there would be, in our community, we would know, there would be a decrease in advertising, which is sometimes 3 to 7 times more than other communities. We know there would be a decrease in tobacco use because we think even if folks in our community tried other products, they would probably be too harsh for them to tolerate to continue smoking.
All right, stick around, Mr. Robinson. We're going to pick this up again in a moment. And you stick around as well. And please call in if you've got thoughts on this, 866-893-5722. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Programming is supported by Rotary International. Rotary is a global network of volunteers dedicated to helping others and communities around the world. For more information, you can visit rotary.org.
Programming is supported by The Restaurant at Hotel Bel Air, a member of Relay and Chateau Gourmand, recipient of a 2007 Zagat Dining Award, Mediterranean-inspired cuisine in a country estate setting. Reservations at hotelbelair.com. Flooding is moving downstream along the Mississippi after two more levees were breached in western Illinois this morning. Residents of the small town of Meyer have been evacuated. Officials are monitoring levees in other Mississippi River towns in Illinois and Missouri. The service organization Rotary International's annual convention wraps up today in L.A. With UNICEF and other international health agencies, Rotary announced a $100 million effort to eradicate polio. Robert Scott, chairman of the Rotary Foundation, says the organization first set that global goal 23 years ago.
It has been the number one program that has brought Rotary to the absolute forefront. I mean, we now can open doors and talk to people in almost any government in the world, whether it's for or against polio eradication.
Polio is a paralyzing viral disease that vaccines have almost wiped out in the developed world. It persists, however, in parts of Africa and South Asia. Rotary hopes to raise the $100 million to fulfill a challenge grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Sexual violence has been a part of military conflicts around the globe. Now the UN is preparing to classify rape as a security threat. Sexual violence and war on the world coming up at noon here on 89.3 KPCC. Another hot day today with temperatures over the century mark. It's 11:21.
This is Air Talk on KPCC 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about new legislation in Congress that would, for the first time, give the FDA control over tobacco products, including banning of most flavored cigarettes. But there's a big loophole. Menthol would not be included. Some say this was a way to get Philip Morris and other tobacco companies to the table. Question here is, does this disproportionately discriminate against black smokers who account for or who favor by about three quarters menthol cigarettes? In other words, 75% of black smokers prefer menthol cigarettes. The largest black anti-smoking group pulled its support for this bill as a result of that. And very curious to get your thoughts on whether this bill is good as it stands, as we heard Congressman Sherman say before, not a perfect bill, but a good bill, or whether this menthol loophole should be deadly to the legislative process. Our number, 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. Let's go to Kristen calling from the freeway. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My point is that we have menthol in cigarettes for a very long time. I mean, that goes back into history. And whereas chocolate and strawberry flavored cigarettes, I've never even heard of that. So it seems like a much bigger deal to eliminate menthol from the market, since it has such a history. I would think that there would be a lot of people up in arms about not getting their, you know, their menthol cigarettes, whereas nobody's really going to be clamoring at the door for their strawberry flavored.
Okay, but wouldn't the point here, Kristen, be that because menthol's been around so long and has such a significant market share, if our goal is to try and get people off cigarettes, then you would want to take away the cigarette that eases so many people into the smoking habit?
Right. I'm just saying that it seems to me that that's a much bigger deal to accomplish, and I don't know who the opponents of this are. I imagine the tobacco industry doesn't want any of this, but I could see how easing into this with flavored cigarettes first and then attacking around the edges of all other smoking is a more reasonable goal.
All right, Kristen, appreciate your thoughts on that. We're also joined by Mitch Zeller. He's former director of the Office of Tobacco Programs at the FDA. Mr. Zeller, menthol you would think would be a natural thing for the FDA to want to regulate.
Well, there's nothing in the legislation that prohibits FDA from doing anything that it wants to menthol. That's one thing that you haven't mentioned to your listeners. It's not included in the list along with strawberry and grape and orange and vanilla and chocolate that is prohibited, but there's explicit language in the legislation that makes it crystal clear that FDA is free to do anything that it wants to menthol if the legislation passes and FDA gets that power back, and that would include banning menthol.
So because it's not explicit, that doesn't mean it's necessarily off the table for the FDA?
No, there's explicit language in the legislation that says that FDA is free to do anything to menthol that it wants. It's just not included in the list of banned candy flavorings in the legislation.
Now, I guess some would say that if menthol was really going to be a high-profile target, it would be on the list of all flavorings, whether we call them candy flavorings or not.
Well, that's a question for Congress, but that's not a question about FDA's ability to get rid of menthol if the agency wants to do that after the legislation passes.
Is it your sense that the agency would want to crack down on menthol?
Let me put it this way. I ran the tobacco program when there was one at FDA before it was shut down by the Supreme Court in the face of litigation from the tobacco companies, and I would put menthol high on the list of things that I would begin to look into if I was back at the agency. But I think the important thing for your audience to understand, and I am a supporter of the legislation, is that there's nothing in this bill that limits FDA's authority in any way to do anything that it wants to menthol if the legislation passes and these powers are given back to FDA.
What do you think FDA's intentions would be if the bill does pass?
I can't speak for the agency. I would like to think that when they have the authority to review the levels of added ingredients in cigarettes, that this would be high up on the list. Obviously, it's gotten a lot of attention And there's no question that African Americans are targeted with the marketing of menthol cigarettes. But it's important for people to understand the FDA would be free to restrict menthol in any way that it wanted to.
All right. William S. Robinson, Executive Director of the African American Tobacco Prevention Network. If that's indeed the case, why is it that your group can't support this?
Because like many times, our community is tasked to wait for legislation with delayed provisions in it, and our community suffers in the meantime. We already know the disproportionate disease and death that's caused in our community from mentholated tobacco use. So why would we, in the interest of protecting the public's health, want any delay? Also understanding how the federal government works is how long is it going to take for the FDA to gear up for this and to gear up to put in place, to conduct studies, and how many more people in our community are going to be sick and ultimately die from this tobacco product while we're doing this when we can take a parenthesis and move it literally three words and include menthol in it, be protected from the beginning.
All right. Your thoughts on this are very welcome. 866-893-5722. RJ calling from Long Beach. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I don't understand why this legislation is so controversial, since it does seem that choosing to smoke with all the information that's given out today is really that. It's just a choice. And so if these individuals are choosing to smoke menthols or whatever other cigarette choice they have, isn't it down to them for their own choice? And so we can't, or we're being asked to legislate personal choice again.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, RJ. It seems to me that most of the critics of flavored cigarettes, including menthol, say that by easing the harsh taste of tobacco, you're making it easier for kids to take up the habit.
But we also, I'm a teacher, and we tell the kids that you ought not smoke. These are the detrimental side effects to your health. And if in the end the parents aren't involved and the community isn't involved and the children are choosing to smoke, why does that fall really on legislation's hands? Why doesn't it fall more on the parents and the communities to watch out and make sure that their kids aren't falling prey to such advertising tactics?
All right. Appreciate your thoughts on that. Thank you very much. Michael calling from Laguna Hills. Welcome to the program.
Yes. One thing that I agree with the caller that was just on, but one of the things that I don't think people are realizing is you're saying that it's going to be discriminatory with the black community because they're going to let menthol cigarettes slide, but I would think that it would be more discriminatory to pull a product that they enjoy and use and then deny them that.
Well, I guess, again, the argument would be here that anything that makes it easier to smoke encourages people to smoke, if you will, and hence menthol cigarettes, which, yes, indeed, they are favored by the vast majority of black smokers. If menthol could be taken off the table, I guess the thinking would be you'd have fewer black smokers, which would probably be a good thing overall.
Yes, and I don't agree with smoking, but I am a smoker, and I my mother is a smoker, and she's not black, and she smokes menthols and has her whole life. It's a choice. It's like unleaded and leaded. When you went to the gas stations, it's been around longer than that. It's not something that is a new flavor. It's not something that is trying to entice children to smoke. It is just either or. When people go to buy cigarettes, they say, I want menthols or they want regulars. It's not fair to the black community to say, well, we decided you're not going to smoke anymore, so there you go.
All right. Thank you very much for your thoughts on that. William Robinson, Executive Director of the African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Your thoughts?
Well, I would love to agree with the last two callers, but you need to understand the history of the tobacco industry. When they first introduced menthol into cigarette products, in the late 50s and the early 60s, they had a specific effort to market mentholated products to urban centers around the country. So they went to Cincinnati, Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and New York, to name a few cities, and specifically studied our culture and incorporated those in their new marketing of this tobacco product when our community did not smoke those tobacco products. And then they began to support our cultural events. They were jazz festivals. They set up scholarship programs. So they kind of bought their way into it and then inundated all those urban communities with advertising that you can still see today. So from the industry's perspective, it looks like a great return on their marketing investment. In our community, health, if you look at it from the health perspective, it's been a siege on our community and an attack on the community that wasn't interested in these products from the beginning. And we have instances through history like the Uptown in Philadelphia where Philip Morris wanted to introduce this new product that wasn't even asked for.
That was R.J. Reynolds, actually.
Yes, that's right. You're correct. And the same thing with the X cigarettes in Boston that were designed to be marketed that coincided with the release of Spike Lee's Malcolm X movie. We didn't ask for those products. They came into our community, and coalitions have had to be organized to fight this. And with that history, why don't we back up a bit on this bill and understand this? We want FDA regulation. We think it's long overdue. But if we have to make concessions that are based on industry fluence, we think we're in the wrong position. And we think we can craft a bill, if we're smart, that the entire public health community can support, and then we'll be with it 100%.
All right, let's take one more call. Norm calling from Washington State. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'd like to respond to what your first caller, Ms. Stahl from the New York Times, mentioned, and also make a brief comment on what Representative Sherman said.
Okay.
First of all, there's a very simple reason why Philip Morris aggressively supports FDA regulation of tobacco, and that is their Aria smoke-free nicotine inhaler introduced October 2005, and their joint venture with Skoal Smokeless Tobacco to produce smokeless tobacco products and manufacture and distribute them in a joint venture. The reason that's important is a study that was published towards a comprehensive nicotine plan, 2005, in the journal Tobacco Control, which is the journal for the tobacco control advocates. Actually, Mr. Robinson has some extremely well-taken points about moving market share because it relates directly to taxation. Zero taxes on smoke-free nicotine products such as Nicoderm CQ, manufactured by Johnson & Johnson, maximum taxes on cigarettes.
All right, Norm, appreciate your thoughts on that very much. Our thanks as well to Stephanie Saul from the New York Times, Congressman Brad Sherman, William Robinson from the African American Tobacco Prevention Network, and Mitch Zeller, former director of the Office of Tobacco Programs at the FDA. Don't you go anywhere, because coming right up, the science of trust. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Commercial radio is paid for with commercials. Public radio is paid for by the public. That would be you. Public radio thrives only when listeners like you decide to become contributing members. Those individual contributions are the largest source of the money it takes to pay for the high-quality news you hear every day. Become a member now. It takes just a minute or two at kpcc.org. Thanks.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus from the LA Times, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Well, trust, it's something that's earned, at least that's what we're taught, or maybe it's something that comes organically from the body. We're joined by Paul Zak. He's founding director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies, there's a fancy name, and professor of economics at Claremont Graduate University. And he's got a very interesting article in the latest edition of Scientific American all about the neurobiology of trust. And it contains a new word for me, oxytocin. All right, what is this and what does it do?
Oxytocin is a very simple molecule that your brain makes. It's ancient in origin, first appeared in fish 100 million years ago to facilitate sexual reproduction. But in humans, we discovered that it works as a trust detector. When someone trusts you, your brain pumps this stuff out, and it motivates you to reciprocate. And it actually makes it feel good. So we feel good when we are trusted and trustworthy.
Why do we have this?
Yeah, great reason. It's like anything in the brain. We evolved first this mechanism to facilitate sex, and then we kind of spun that out into care for offspring, which is the hallmark of mammals. And from there, we discovered in human beings that it makes us care about complete strangers. So civilization would not be possible without oxytocin, I claim, because we have to be able to live and work around strangers, people don't know. So we need something in our heads that says, David's safe, and this guy in the street, not safe. Should I let this person approach me or let the other person approach me, yes or no? So we're constantly balancing appropriate levels of trust and distrust. And indeed, in the tails of that distribution is pathology. If you trust no one, you're paranoid. That's pathological. If you trust everybody, you're gullible and you're taken advantage of. You can't survive. So we're constantly going through the world trying to figure out, should I trust this stranger or should I not trust this stranger?
And you cite in your article the fact that because we as a species have such long adolescence, you need to develop this ability to trust and not trust for the sake of self-preservation, if nothing else, because you've got to fit in to a group that will harbor you until you become an adult.
That's right. So humans are unusual in two levels. One, we have this extraordinarily long adolescence, which you have these little parasites called children who suck resources from us. And so we have to be willing to bond to them, to care about them. And because of this long adolescence, which came about because of the big brains of humans, you're not born with a fully functioning brain, then this care for adolescents evolved into, well, maybe I care about my neighbor. And maybe I care about the guy down the street who sells wheat and I sell corn and we can trade. So all of a sudden we went from having this long adolescence to being able to form societies. Even your last segment on smoking, think about the regulation issues. It's really a trust issue. Do I trust these yahoos in Washington to actually do the right thing for individuals here at home? So all of society, I think, depends on the appropriate levels of trust and distrust. And we're constantly shuttling between, no, I don't trust, I do trust. But we have this beautiful thing in our head that evolved to allow us to live in large societies around strangers. And that's the second thing that's unusual about humans. We like to be around strangers. We like living in big cities. It's exciting for us. Other animals do not do that. They want to live around their own offspring, those they're mated with and bonded to. We like being around strangers. So we have to figure out who to trust and who not to trust.
Now, correct me if I have it wrong, but oxytocin. Here we are sitting across from each other here in the studio. Now, oxytocin makes me want to trust you. That in turn sparks oxytocin in you, which makes you decide that I am trustworthy, and hence trust is formed. Is that correct?
Not exactly right. So the initiation of trust is not formed by oxytocin. When someone trusts us, our brains release this stuff and say, oh, this person has signaled that they're saved. I want to play ball with them. So why we initiate trust depends less on oxytocin or more on the fear issue. If you look scary, I'm not going to trust you. So we're constantly balancing, you know, how much should I trust this person? It's like your mom told you when you were three, honey, put on nice clothes because your appearance matters. People are going to make a judgment about you based on how you appear, as well as your body language. And David, we also did this funny ritual that humans do when they meet. We touched our palms together. Why is that?
To make sure we're not armed?
Maybe, but I think that's just a myth. I think it's getting a lot of physiologic information about your own internal state. Are you stressed? Are you calm? Are you sweaty? Are you not sweaty? And we have recent findings coming out in just a couple months showing that touch, in fact, primes the brain to release oxytocin.
Right.
So I made you want to trust me.
We're talking about the science of trust in a very trustworthy fashion. Your calls will be welcome momentarily. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle.
California Report stories on 89.3 KPCC are made possible by the Evelyn and Walter Haas Jr. Fund, the AARP and its 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable quality health care for all Californians, online at aarp.org, and by OSH, Complete Home and Garden Service to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. Well, it's time to win a pair of tickets to the Hollywood Bowl July 4th concert and fireworks spectacular. It's for the 7:30 performance. It's actually on July 2nd. The L.A. Philharmonic salutes America's favorite pastime and celebrates the Dodgers' 50th anniversary in L.A. There'll be classic baseball music, appearances by Dodger greats, and a very special guest, Randy Newman. Tickets at HollywoodBowl.com. We'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. The powerful L.A. County Federation of Labor has endorsed instant runoff voting. KPCC's Frank Stoltz reports that political activists want to place the reform on the November ballot.
Under instant runoff voting, voters rank their favorite candidates on the ballot. If nobody wins a majority of first-choice votes, the least popular candidate is eliminated, and his or her supporters' second-choice votes are counted. The process continues until one candidate wins most voters' support. The idea is to eliminate the need for a runoff election months later, save money, and boost voter participation. The New America Foundation, a nonprofit public policy institute, is leading a campaign to introduce instant runoff voting for the Los Angeles City Council, School Board, and Community College Board of Trustees seats. Opponents defend traditional runoff elections because they allow voters to better vet candidates. The LA City Council has until July 2nd to put the issue on the November ballot. Frank Stoltz, 89.3 KPCC.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We're joined by Paul Zak. He's founding director of the Center for Neuroeconomics Studies. Boy, and that must be catnip to the ladies. And professor of economics at Claremont Graduate University. We're talking about his research into oxytocin, which is a hormone that, well, might be the foundation of trust. And I'm going to throw open the switchboard at this point, too, to get your sense of trust. How is it earned? And does it change the nature of trust to you if it's reduced to basically a chemical response as opposed to a sociological phenomenon? Our numbers, 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. So, Mr. Zak, clearly when we talk about oxytocin, which is the hormone here, as a chemical response to the need for trust in human beings, it seems to raise all sorts of interesting ramifications. And first, there's some real-world things that your article in Scientific American raises. For instance, you found that there were low levels of oxytocin among autistic children. What does that imply?
That's correct. So there's a variety of psychiatric and neurologic disorders in which there are dysfunctions in social behaviors. Autism is one of those, social phobia, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease. And a variety of these we've now found are associated with low levels of oxytocin. So if oxytocin is low, then I'm not motivated to socially engage. Again, remember the evolution of oxytocin. It first appeared to facilitate sexual reproduction, which requires that someone get close to you, right, and their animal get close to you. So it's doing the same thing here. If you don't have much oxytocin, it says, I don't want to get close to people, even in a social intercourse sense. I just want to kind of stay in my own corner. So there are a very large number of clinical trials going since we've discovered this, looking at different clinical applications of oxytocin. And I should say this is a generic drug, so it's very inexpensive and it's extraordinarily safe. It doesn't really interact with many other hormones in the body.
So does that mean that if we give oxytocin to a paranoid schizophrenic, suddenly he or she is less paranoid?
Perhaps not less paranoid, but a little more plugged in with people around them. So again, all these disorders are multifactorial. There's many causes on them. Having said that, you have a route into the brain now in which you can kind of facilitate empathy. So I think of oxytocin as a physiologic signature for empathy. It makes me care a little bit more about the people around me. Again, it could be friends and family, but as we've shown, complete strangers can induce you to release oxytocin. And that's why if we're walking down the street and we see someone who falls and trips their ankle, breaks their ankle, we feel bad and we care and we invest resources to help them. So we actually are physically connected to other people through the workings of oxytocin.
And yet you're reducing human response that we would call empathy and compassion to an electrochemical process.
And I would say this all comes from love, in fact. This is the hormone of love. It's the cuddle hormone.
Sweet.
I don't want to say reduce. I think it all comes down to care. It tells us that we are really connected to others. We do experiments in which individuals are physically separated. They're computer terminals. They're showing they trust each other by transferring money to some stranger. And yet this still induces the brain to pump out oxytocin. So imagine how much more relevant and strong these feelings are when you have someone directly in front of you who needs your care. So it says, I'm safe. I'm a person who wants to interact with you. And indeed, people who don't do that, people who don't want to interact with others, provoke an aggressive response. So if you fall and no one helps you, think, oh, wow, what a jerk this person is. I need a little bit of help. They could give me a hand. They could open the door for me. They don't do it. It makes you angry. So we support cooperative behaviors both by making it feel good in the brain. Oxytocin induces this reward chemical in your brain called dopamine to be released. So it rewards us for being cooperative or even virtuous, I would say, and also provokes aggression when we're not doing that. When you see that jerk going down the street who bumped into you and didn't say sorry or cut you off in traffic, yeah, you get pretty angry.
Well, that explains everything then.
There you go.
Once again, our switchboards are open. If you have any questions for Professor Paul Zak, they're welcome. Also, your thoughts on the nature of trust. Is it a chemical process or is it something that is earned? Or really, are we saying the same thing right there? Our number is 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. And Mr. Zak, I guess maybe it's the conspiracy theorist in me when that pops up sometimes. But when I was reading your article, I was thinking, boy, how could this insight into oxytocin play out in the real world? And I imagined a political rally whereby a politician sprays oxytocin into the air. Will that engender greater trust among listeners?
That's right. Relevant question.
Not that I'm giving anyone an idea,
yeah. So how do we know we're right? Maybe we're total schmucks, right? So we measure this stuff, your brain releasing this stuff. Maybe we're just wrong. So to show that oxytocin is the causative factor inducing trust, we developed a nasal spray. So we took synthetic oxytocin, we put it in an inhaler, and we shoot it up your nose. And we wait for an hour. It diffuses into your brain. And indeed, we can double the number of people who trust a stranger with all of their money. So it has a profound effect on trust. We've also found recently on generosity. People are much more generous in sharing resources when we increase the level of oxytocin in their brains. Okay, so having said that, could politicians or salespeople spritz this stuff in the air? And the answer is no, for two reasons. One, we need a lot in your brain to actually have an effect. So we're putting 2 teaspoons of liquid in your nose and having you suck it up. You pretty much know you're getting a lot of this stuff. Second, if it's spritz in the air, it's in your skin, there's very little that transfers from the skin directly into the blood. And then once it's in the blood, very little goes from the blood into the brain. So you'd have to actually kind of bathe in this stuff heavily. So if I, had a tidal wave of oxytocin, flowing over the audience, I think they'd be pretty aware of that.
So it's not like some Las Vegas casino could suddenly spike the drinks with oxytocin. And suddenly everyone's trusting the dealer more.
That's right. So oxytocin is broken down in the gut. So it's either inject you with a needle or put it up your nose. So again, either way, you're going to know you're getting it. Having said that, I think con men are excellent at causing our own brain to release this. They do all the things that try to make themselves look trustworthy. They tell you about their family. They tell you about their business. They make you care about them. And that often makes you open up your wallet. So people who are smart, and I would include politicians in that group, are good at making us trust them. And you might, again, reduce the decision in the presidential election to who do I trust more?
So a charismatic politician is actually evoking an oxytocin response in listeners?
I would suspect so.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that explains a lot about Bill Clinton, doesn't it?
There you go. People said you're the only person in the room when you meet Bill Clinton.
Our number again, 866-893-5722. Kevin calling from Pasadena. Welcome to the program. Kevin, you there?
Yes, hi.
All right. I trust you to talk. Go ahead.
Just had a comment. A lot of people think that it's somehow. First of all, I want to say a great, fascinating research, very thought provoking. A lot of people find it disparaging that maybe our feelings are only tied to molecules, and I don't think it's at all the case. I think it's more that we should be exalting the molecules because they do seem to have such tremendous power.
Okay, fair enough. Paul Zak,
thank you very much, Kevin. I agree with you. I think once we discover the brain basis for these behaviors, we see how amazingly extraordinary they are. Can you imagine that we would send money to starving children in Africa or victims of Hurricane Katrina? We do this because they draw on our emotions. They draw on our need to care for others. And finding out that there's a physiologic substrate for this doesn't reduce it. To me, it makes it extraordinary, if you have said.
All right. Let's take another call. Nina calling from Long Beach. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. The main functions of oxytocin are milk letdown and uterine contraction. And so one would think maybe women produce more oxytocin. I don't personally know. And, as for whether we're run by our genes and our chemistry, I couldn't give you a source, but apparently a great many of our traits, 51%, let's say, do come from our genetics, even something like religiosity. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, Nina just brought up a very interesting point, the connection between religion and oxytocin. Do you see something there as well? Because the nature of belief is so ephemeral in many ways. Most people don't really understand where it comes from except from this innate desire to connect to a belief system. It would seem that oxytocin would be the freeway on which that car would be traveling.
Exactly right. So actually, the new book I'm working on is called The Moral Molecule. And I think oxytocin is one of the factors that makes us moral. It makes us believe both in other people and I think also in a higher being. If you think of the history of life, 99% of humans have believed in a god or gods, and that is almost always a parental figure. So again, oxytocin is about care for offspring, about care for others around us. And that also sounds like a way that we manifest how we believe in God. So I think it's not surprising that the brain uses all these mechanisms for similar behaviors. Now, it's not to say that God may have implanted this in your head. I'm not a theologian. I have nothing to say about this. I'm just a lowly scientist. But the mechanisms seem to be in similar pathways. So we have done some work on moral behaviors on oxytocin, and we find that belief systems are not fundamentally influenced by oxytocin. That is, if I shoot you up with oxytocin, you are not a more moral person, but you do tend to take more risks with other people. That is, you take another risk with another person. You're more willing to trust, you're more willing to be generous, but if I asked you to solve a moral dilemma, would you kill one person to save seven others for sure? That isn't affected by oxytocin. So there seems to be a sort of a separate module in the brain that is specific for moral behaviors.
Meaning you've got a safeguard that kicks in.
Exactly right. And I should say, when we put people on oxytocin, we put hundreds on this very, very safe drug, that there are people who are kind of not affected by this at all. So again, your more evolved area of the brain. Oxytocin receptors are a very old, evolutionary old area of the brain associated with emotions. But the newer areas of the brain, particularly in humans, this prefrontal cortex, modulate that activity. So I may put you on oxytocin and you say, you know what, don't feel like being trusting today. Just not going to do it. That's fine. We see a proportion of people doing that. We also find about 2% of our subjects are sociopaths. They have a real dysfunction in oxytocin. That is, they're not affected by trust at all. Their brains don't release oxytocin. They don't reciprocate. And they enjoy taking advantage of others. Now, 2% isn't bad. It means 98% of the time, with just a little bit of investigation, you can kind of figure out from body language, eye contact, who you should trust, who you shouldn't trust. 2% of the time means once in a while you're going to make a mistake, but hopefully not too many times.
Your thoughts, your questions are very welcome on this topic. 866-893-5722. Rita calling from West L.A. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I'm wondering if humor doesn't have a good deal to do with how people trust one another. If they can share a laugh, would that possibly be involved this part of the brain? And I'll take my answer off.
Paul Zak.
What a wonderful question. It turns out that humor does activate reward mechanisms of the brain. It feels good to laugh. And laughter mostly happens with other people around. It's much easier to laugh in a movie when you're in a theater full of people than you're watching at home by yourself. Why is that? Because it is a bonding agent. So again, the same mechanisms that allow us to interact with other people in an appropriate way are facilitated by laughter, and this utilizes oxytocin. So we're a hypersocial species, sometimes called the hypersocial ape. Why is that? Because we like to be around the other people, and laughter, smiling, eye contact, and touch are ways that we sustain those relationships.
And it seems like there's also a cascading effect where oxytocin perhaps kicks in the laughter. The laughter, in turn, results in more laughter, which results in more oxytocin. And before you know it, we all trust each other.
Exactly right. And one of the earlier callers asked about kind of the developmental effects. So it turns out that in animals, at least, that animals that are neglected by their mother right around birth don't develop many oxytocin receptors, even though they should have a brain full of these things. So people who don't get enough nurturing may not have the capacity to release oxytocin. And this is one of the active areas of research that we're doing now. How much can you retune this system? Can I take a child who's neglected and then kind of restart them into appropriate social behaviors, or are you kind of stuck with what you have? It's a very important open question.
Or you just make them radio hosts.
Or make them radio hosts so you can see how well you're doing.
Exactly. Let's take another call. Julie calling from Highland. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was curious about if the research has shown if there's people that may have too much oxytocin, say people that have relationship addictions or like they're in the manic phase of bipolar disorder. And then secondly, I was wondering about children, when you were bringing up children just a few minutes ago, children that have been exposed either prenatal or at a very young age to all the chemicals like in a meth lab.
All right, good questions.
Right. So we find that social phobics actually have very high levels of oxytocin. So think of oxytocin as sort of an on-off switch. When I see David, he looks safe. I switch on oxytocin and say, he's a guy I can approach. He seems okay. He seems safe. I should trust him. If the switch is always on, then the brain doesn't get any signal. It doesn't know what to do with that. So an analogy would be like a type 2 diabetics. If you're constantly eating and your brain's constantly releasing insulin or causing your pancreas to release insulin, then the signal starts to be useless. Your brain doesn't know what to do with that. Your body stops listening to this. It shuts down the receptors for it. So these systems in the brain are very complicated, and they have feedback loops. They're dynamic. So a one-time effect of, say, meth use may not interrupt this system radically. Researchers recently in England found that ecstasy induced, which is associated with greater social behaviors, induces oxytocin release. So it's not that you don't have the hormone there. It's that it's not working in the right areas in your brain.
Ray, calling from Orange. Welcome to the program.
Yeah. How you doing? Great research. I was wondering, I know there's research on Fernums that shows that it triggers some, in some folks, aggression. And I'm wondering if oxytocin creates the same effect in some folks as well.
Great question. We don't know yet. We do know that oxytocin is released in a way that's not open to conscious awareness, like Fernums' work. So if you're releasing oxytocin, you're not going to be aware of it. You may be just a little bit calmer and more relaxed. And that's a good thing. It allows us to go through life. If you've ever had a child, people in the audience who've had children, you know that, you know, the first year is terrible. You're not sleeping, and you haven't been a parent who haven't thought for 2 seconds, like, I just want to throw this crying baby out the window and just get some sleep. Why don't we do that? Oxytocin down-regulates this sort of anxiety that we have. And sometimes that's anxiety externally, or sometimes anxiety of having people around us. So there is a sense in which we're calmer. So again, the easiest way to release oxytocin, besides breastfeeding or giving birth, is to have sexual intercourse. So there's this bonding that goes on between people who are sexually intimate, and that utilizes oxytocin.
Since there's such a close correlation between sex and oxytocin, what about so-called sex addicts? Are they just running amok with oxytocin?
I think it's the opposite. I think they're very low in oxytocin. They're using this to kind of juice the system. So it's like young men who engage in risk-taking behaviors, the kind of areas in the brain that sort of modulate our desire to engage in crazy activities, jumping out of airplanes and driving too fast, kind of wire up late in life. And for young men, they are kind of dysfunctional. So if you have low levels of these chemicals in your brain, then you do things to try to juice them up. So I think sex addicts would be people who really want connection but don't have it. And we find this in our sociopaths in our samples as well. They have a lot of sexual partners. They're not kind of attaching to one person. So humans are mostly monogamous or serially monogamous. We tend to go from kind of one person to one person. And in monogamous mammals, which are about 5% of the mammals, that's when oxytocin actually generalizes, not from just here's a partner I have now for the next 10 minutes to here's how I care about people in my general society.
All right. Paul Zak, founding director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies and professor of economics at Claremont Graduate University, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
All right. And once again, I want to give my thanks and trust to all the producers and engineers here at KPCC who make this job so much fun to do. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in for Larry Mantle. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.